You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 64. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about Indigenous education, climate change, and technologies of care. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute People's Treaty Lands, the Dineta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. So today we have Dr. Clint Carroll on the show. Clint Carroll is an associate professor of Native American and Indigenous Studies in the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. A citizen of the Cherokee Nation, he works at the intersections of Indigenous Studies, Anthropology, and Political Ecology, with an emphasis on Cherokee environmental governance and land-based resurgence. So welcome to the show, Clint.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so you are somebody that has been recommended to be on the show multiple times for a long time. So I'm very excited to finally have you on. And just like I was telling you off air, so much to talk about. So let's just get started at the beginning.
Great. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah. So what got you interested in this kind of work?
Well, it's a long story, but I'll try to be, I think it's all related to really the work as a whole, and how I got started has really just been kind of a continuation of what I'm doing now. So with that in mind, my path through academia has been a windy one. And so I started off at a local university in North Texas and didn't do very well. I'm a first generation college student and didn't have a whole lot of direction at first. So I took some time to do some work out of the academy, out of the university, and did a little bit of traveling and then went back to a community college, local community college in Dallas. And from there, really just was taking courses that really piqued my interest. And one of them, well, took a lot of language courses and then took an anthropology course. And as a combination of that experience and really kind of drawing from the experiences that I had outside of the university context, really wanting to kind of put my passion and interest in language and in working with people and learning about different struggles and cultural issues, really piqued my interest in pursuing a degree in anthropology, but primarily with the interest of being able to use that training and those skills to go back and work with my community. For a little bit of context, I grew up in Texas. As you said, I'm a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, but I primarily grew up away from community. And so it was a way for me to think about, you know, how can I put my educational pursuits in service of my nation, the people, and in the process, make meaningful connections that I did not have the opportunity to grow up with. And that includes the language. And so I started getting, you know, really passionate about learning my ancestral language. Back in the day, we had, you know, cassettes, right? And so, well, we had CDs, of course, but I bought what was then only available on cassette, Cherokee language tapes, and listened to those over and over. And okay, I'll get back to the story at hand, but that was a formative part, is just kind of thinking, okay, here's this, this part of who I am and my ancestry. How can I eventually find my way back home, so to speak? So what I did was I went to the office hours of one of my, the anthropology instructor at Richland Community College. And he was, you know, just very supportive of the very few Native students who were in his class, pointing me in the direction of Arizona. And specifically, and this is the funny part, he pointed me to ASU, Arizona State. And I said, okay, great. Well, he said they've got a great program in anthropology. Go check them out. And so part of my story is I went, you know, online and applied to a university in Arizona and got the confirmation email back saying, you know, thank you for your application to the University of Arizona. And I said, oh, wait. And I didn't know that they were two different institutions. So, but as fate would have it, I ended up pursuing, and I was fortunate enough to go to continue my bachelor's education at U of A in Tucson, and ended up just like never looking back, made some amazing connections to the Bureau of Applied Research and Anthropology there, as well as really the one of the foundational, if not the foundational programs in American Indian Studies at U of A, worked with some amazing folks and continue to work with them to this day, which really, you know, that combination of excellent programs formed who I am as a scholar in terms of methodology, in terms of approach to research generally. And, you know, I'll always be indebted to the faculty there who have kind of fostered that in me. And so those two things, you know, looking at both of those programs, I would say are the emphasis on, you know, what are the outcomes of the work that we do in the communities? You know, how does this matter? And I think that stretches across applied anthropology and American Indian Studies, which both have that just strong emphasis in work that makes a difference out in the world. And so, you know, that continued to kind of foster and nurture within, you know, my mind as a budding researcher, scholar, activist, you know, community-based researcher. What can I be doing that is applicable back home? And through that process of gaining research experience, it took me to northern Mexico in Sonora. It took me to the Bahamas, of all places. I worked there with local fishers surrounding the implementation of marine protected areas. So, you know, looking at local knowledge and how that interfaces with policy and conservation work, all of that contributed to eventually at the end of my bachelor's degree, going back home. And I say home in all the different, you know, larger meanings of the sense, because that's where community is, that's where extended relatives are. So I went back to Oklahoma and started working for my tribe, the Cherokee Nation, as a luckily paid intern. It was actually an environmental technician is what they call them. But that's a part of that story, is going back and asking around, you know, what specifically. I was working for the Environmental Services Office. You know, what can the skills, the experiences that I've been able to garner as a, you know, as a young researcher, how can I apply those to the community? And as it turned out, that office and that department, if you will, had a director who was looking for ways to incorporate traditional knowledge into the work that they did on a daily basis. And that office is essentially like the EPA for the Cherokee Nation. And what came out of that experience was really grappling with this question in my mind of, okay, we've got an environmental protection office for all intents and purposes. How is it that we've come this far as an indigenous nation, and we're not able to, or we haven't had that conversation around incorporating our own ways of knowing and ways of viewing the world into this office and how it functions? And from there, it just kind of launched into my graduate work, which is another story. But that was actually preceding the beginning of my PhD work at UC Berkeley in environmental science, policy, and management. And then the rest kind of flowed from there in kind of an iterative way. You know, Berkeley was a culture shock for me big time in terms of the different type of academic culture. Graduate school period, not knowing necessarily what I got myself into. And, you know, it took some time to adjust, but always thinking about that formative experience, not only as an undergrad, but working for my tribe that summer before grad school. And I continued that. I continued going back during the summers and, like, you know, again, iteratively working on this longer project that really extends up to the present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, looking at your CV, for example, that you have interests in a lot of different areas, you know, like anthropology, environmental, education, even health. Mm-hmm. And to me, you know, as a cultural anthropologist, the connection between all of them totally makes sense. But when you were in that period, like when you were looking at going to grad school, mm-hmm. when you were looking to going to work for your tribe, you know, were you having a hard time kind of figuring out what direction you wanted to go in, or was it at that point clear in your mind what you wanted to do?
Yeah, that's a great question, because like kind of going off of what you said, like in, you know, from your perspective, all the connections are pretty much there. It's hard to compartmentalize all these different, what, you know, what we might section out in the university setting. You know, they don't have those types of boundaries necessarily in the real world, and especially for tribal communities, I would say. But for me, it's part and parcel to, I think, being first generation, I think has a lot to do with it. And I think I'm still learning, because I have all these interests and I have all these opportunities that may arise. And I think, well, yeah, of course that makes sense. But, you know, to others, it may be kind of outside of that disciplinary realm. And so they don't pursue it. And for me, I'm always trying to find ways to say, well, yes, absolutely. For example, the relationship between the environmental work that I started out doing and health. And, you know, that's been kind of a direction I've been taking more and more. And then, you know, of course, a lot of the health sciences are starting to come around to acknowledging the connection between whether it be green space or conservation, or just generally the relationship between the health of the land and the health of communities. And, you know, going back to what I was saying previously about discipline, like disciplinary boundaries, we look at the field of Indigenous studies, for example, and it's inherently an interdisciplinary field. And I'm starting to call it an anti-discipline, actually, more and more, because it just kind of refuses or doesn't really fit into any box. And there's so many, you know, scholars, so much amazing work going on in that field that doesn't necessarily have to be confined to a discipline necessarily. And so it's just a matter of seeing what is, you know, what are the concerns in the community, and how do I translate that to work that, again, reciprocates and kind of feeds back into actual, you know, outcomes and things that will kind of help move things forward in productive and generative ways. But yeah, it's also been, so I, going back to the first gen thing, like, not really having a preordained, like, okay, this is what I want to do. This is, you know, it was all kind of new to me. Like the idea of going for a PhD was not something I would have imagined without the help of programs that were there for that exact purpose. Like I went through the McNair program at U of A. I went through another program called the Summer Research Institute, which actively worked with first gen and, you know, marginalized students to craft, you know, personal statements, to study for the GREs, which I failed miserably at those. But fortunately, that wasn't something that my PhD program was paying too much attention to. And now I think they're becoming less and less something that people look to when it comes to admissions. But nonetheless, made it to that process and made it to Berkeley. And my family was just kind of blown away. And so was I, for that matter. And then made it through Berkeley, which was in itself, you know, just a very foreign type of culture academically, but then had a lot of help along the way there, forging community with the American Indian Graduate Program and, you know, folks within my department, you know, my cohort, who are also kind of experiencing the same type of culture shock. So, you know, community has always been a big thing throughout along the way. And thinking about those doors that open, that I walk through, it may not have been logical in terms of, you know, someone who was just confined to like one discipline, but I've been really fortunate to kind of make those connections in different ways. And as you said, like working with, you know, more health sciences oriented programs. I was a fellow for the Native Investigator Development Program that really got me thinking about, you know, the intersections between the work that I was doing with my community and how that would be, you know, thought of or how that would be approached from a health sciences perspective. And so I learned different ways of looking at research and, you know, research questions and writing that I think have just made the work itself stronger and have made me a better scholar. And others may, you know, have a perspective of like, well, if you're not, you know, completely committed to one track, then you kind of dilute yourself. But I don't know. My sense is that, you know, multiple perspectives, as many as possible, are going to help strengthen your your approach to the work generally.
Yeah, no. And I mean, I think people do that. They just do it in a different way. So they'll silo themselves to a discipline, but then they'll look at a whole bunch of different things within that discipline. Whereas it seems like for you, you took kind of one topic in some ways and then looked at it through the lens of a whole bunch of different disciplines, which I think is just as interesting and just as useful. It's just a different, it's not like the quote unquote, you know, traditional academic normal way of doing things. But in some ways, I think that's a more interesting approach or more hitting at all of the complexity that the topic deserves, I guess.
Yeah. It's been frustrating too, in that I'm trying to speak to multiple fields. And I think in that sense, it may be a little, you know, stretching myself too thinly, but I just keep going back to like accountability, like who am I really accountable to at the end of the day? And it's not, you know, anthropology, it's not political ecology, it's the folks who I work with. And so, like you said, like if you take that, the kind of grounded questions or grounded issues, and then kind of apply multiple disciplinary perspectives to them, what remains at the end of it are those questions and that commitment to reciprocal research projects. And so I am in no way like bashing those who do kind of take that single track, you know, single discipline approach, but my path has been different, and whether that has been, you know, haphazard or intentional, I'm still figuring out. But at the end of it, it's still like, again, that my compass is, or, you know, where my sights are set on is how I can take these tools and resources and really apply them to making a difference back home, and you know, and along the way, learning in the process, and you know, contributing to kind of the fields that I am invested in as well, but only in the service of, you know, how that translates to some on the ground stuff, you know, with the community. So.
Perfect. Well, we're already at our first break point, but when we come back, I want to go back and dive into your PhD work and then continue on your journey from there.
Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Register of Professional Archaeologists and the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com, and check out the link in the show notes.
Okay, so we're back from break, and I want to go back to Berkeley and your dissertation work, and where that whole journey of your current work started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I, you know, mentioned going into grad school, having had some preliminary experience with some of the, well, you know, through the work that I mentioned about with the Environmental Services Office. And, you know, what that did was it kind of launched me into that experience with some preliminary questions in my mind. And it got me thinking about, well, in relation to the readings and the, you know, seminars that I was having at Berkeley, you know, how to apply some of this thinking and theory and, you know, methodological approaches to what would eventually become my dissertation fieldwork project. And it also exposed me to, you know, of course, in grad school, I had a advisor who said it best. He said, and this was in response to me kind of raising some concerns about the amount of reading that we did. He said, it's grad school. You read a lot of crap. You know, you just read. And in that process, you know, going and spending hours in the library, looking at work that had been, you know, Berkeley has a great library. And so looking at, you know, dissertations, theses, and, you know, publications that were, you know, a product of some anthropological work back in the 60s and 70s in Oklahoma with Cherokee people. and learning a lot along that way about our own tribal history, but then the politics within kind of the reestablishment of our constitutional government, which, you know, 1907 marked the beginning of the state of Oklahoma, the establishment of that state. And of course, that was on the heels and in the middle of, but on the heels of the Dawes Act, the Allotment Act, and, you know, which was for all intents and purposes, a way to dissolve tribal nations and break up communal land holdings and privatize property and create a bunch of individuals that had once been a nation and like a collective. And so that, you know, Cherokees clearly made it through that, but it had a lot of just profound and devastating repercussions in terms of land holding, in terms of governance. And there was this period of, I wouldn't say inaction by any means, but there was definitely a period where the nation, the government of the Cherokee Nation was operating in kind of this shell of a way that it had once been as compared to what it once was. And it's been impacted really since that time, even in the present. And I talk about this in the book and what later, you know, it was the dissertation, what later became the book, that, you know, the type of government that we see operating now is very different from pre-statehood Cherokee Nation and pre-removal Cherokee Nation. But nonetheless, the PhD work was, you know, just that process of, okay, let's dig deep into not only our political history going back to, you know, pre-removal times, but what was going on during the 60s and 70s was really informative to me, because I was dealing with some of the manifestations of those types of politics with the type of work that I was doing, which was, you know, again, at this interface between government, the Environmental Services Office, and later that became the Natural Resources Department, and the community. So working with knowledge keepers, elders, those who, you know, operate from, well, a non-bureaucratic way, you know, so it doesn't mean that folks who embodied that perspective didn't work with the tribe or work in the tribal government, but by nature of the institutionalization of, you know, governance in a kind of more bureaucratic, you know, this apparatus of the Cherokee Nation government, it created this split between those two ways of looking at the world. So all of that is to say that those preliminary questions that I came in with were about that fundamental kind of head scratcher, you know, hey, we're a sovereign nation. We have our own environmental protection agency, if you will. And yet, why is it that I, this young, naive, I'll say it, you know, pre-grad student, was being asked to, okay, you know, take this book of, you know, ethnobotanical information and try to translate that into a database that will inform how we do our job in order to accommodate the fact that we need this knowledge reflected in the policies, the day-to-day. And so it was a daunting, like, request, but it turned out to be just the kind of the springboard on which, you know, my future graduate work engaged. And, you know, what later became relationships that I established with those knowledge keepers formed into a very interesting group that served as kind of this counterbalance, and still do. And I can say more about them because I continue to work with this group of elders. They call themselves the Cherokee Nation Medicine Keepers. We've sustained our work together since 2008 when they formed up into the present. And to see them come about and really, again, provide this counterbalance to a bureaucratic way of operating and therefore kind of insert or, you know, affect change from their own culturally grounded perspective spoke volumes to all the stuff that I've been reading. You know, like I was mentioning, the anthropologists in the 60s and the 70s writing about, oh, there's this split between the tribe, the government, and the communities. And, you know, how do you bridge that kind of divide that really has its origins in these colonially imposed frameworks, but nonetheless frameworks with which Cherokee people have been working for quite some time. So anyway, all that's to say is that it is just kind of a moment in which I was like, okay, let's look at this in historical context, and let's look at the through line of Cherokee sovereignty and peoplehood. And then let's look at these kind of tensions between bureaucratic ways of operating and, for lack of a better term, cultural ways of operating, and find ways to kind of, you know, continue this through line of Cherokee adaptation and modification of state forms to basically ensure the continuance of the people regardless. So it's not to say that everything's, you know, hunky-dory and there aren't any issues and that there still aren't tensions between those different realms. But what I'd hope to do through my graduate work is to kind of, you know, really dig deep into what those tensions were, why they were happening and continue to happen, and how this type of work at the interface between traditional knowledge, traditional environmental knowledge, and tribal governance could, you know, what it could say about it and how it could, you know, offer some sort of answers to these predicaments and issues and therefore ways forward. So that's kind of what became the research prospectus, was, you know, kind of trying to think through those intersections. And, you know, what ended up, you know, happening as a result, you know, through my training was that, you know, I was trying to fit those types of questions and by extension, settler colonialism as a structure and indigeneity and indigenous sovereignty into political ecology, which as a field, or some would say a subfield of anthropology and geography, hadn't addressed any of those questions, you know, dealing with indigenous sovereignty and nationhood and settler colonialism. And so, you know, really kind of engaging in that way, like, okay, political ecology to me as a set of questions, as an approach to research, you know, social environmental research was really interesting. And that was what I was being trained to kind of think through the lens of. But again, like I said, it wasn't intersecting, or it hadn't intersected with indigenous studies at that time. And so trying to find those ways to kind of think through the connections, whether, you know, be on a theoretical level as well as a practical level, was, you know, kind of my experience as a grad student. And you know, I'm still obviously thinking through those questions, but the disfield work kind of helped put that into, you know, ground them and, you know, make it more real for me as opposed to the type of high theory that I was reading in Berkeley.
Yeah. Okay. So for everyone who's listening, the book that you reference is Roots of Our Renewal, Ethnobotany and Cherokee Environmental Governance. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes, and I will be ordering it after this episode. So definitely check it out. And you covered so much. There's so many things that I could touch on. I think this is a really interesting way to use political ecology. So looking at the Cherokee Nation, and, you know, there's removal. And obviously that has an effect on the way people interact with the environment. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Dawes Act that you're talking about, an allotment, and the breakup of that land that they were mm-hmm. removed to. And then, you know, all of these other things that you're talking about. So I guess, could you mm-hmm. talk a little bit about, like, the relationship of the Cherokee to the land, like, through all of those phases, I guess? Not that that's not a gigantic question, but, like, you know, super, super quick and dirty version.
Yeah, I'll take a stab at it. And before I say anything more, thanks for plugging the book. I want to mention too, that if folks are wondering, you know, how they can contribute, you know, we as academics see very little in terms of royalties from our books, but in this case, the royalties that I do see go back to the Medicine Keepers and back to the Cherokee Nation to support continuing that work. So if you want to learn more about that project and that, what I just described, and help contribute, go ahead and buy the book.
Awesome. Is there a way that people can donate directly to the project itself?
Yes. We're still working on, like, making it, like, super easy. But right now, if you go to Cherokee Nation's website and click on donate, it'll require that you kind of specify or in hopefully there's a notes section, but essentially it's the Ethnobiology Fund. If you want to inquire with Cherokee Nation or go on their donation site, that's what they know it as. And that's through the Secretary of Natural Resources Office. So yeah, thanks for asking.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, so to your question, it is a huge question. And it's something I've thought a lot about, both in the book and then later in other publications, about relating, maintaining relationships to land amid forced relocation, amid the dispossession of lands really like right out from under Cherokee people's feet due to the allotment policy. You know, that question or that statement, you know, relating to land despite all of that has been a huge challenge. And it informs a lot of my work, including up to the present, really just kind of thinking about how Cherokee people are navigating such a landscape, both physically and, you know, even just kind of mentally navigating because of the impacts of, you know, what went hand in hand with allotment, which was assimilation. So, you know, how to deal with not only maintaining relationships to land, but maintaining that through the lens of the Cherokee language, through the lens of generational teachings, whether they be through story or through, you know, interpersonal lessons that are out on the land. All of that comes with a huge set of obstacles, whether they be physical in the form of fences or, you know, angry landowners, you know, private property, that type of thing. Or whether they be obstacles of, you know, just trying to remember the name of a certain plant in our language, or trying to remember what grandma said about this plant, you know. And so that's what we're working toward, is to combat all of that, to counteract all of that in concerted ways, working, you know, hand in hand with the medicine keepers and our natural resource or Secretary of Natural Resources staff, who on a daily basis have to confront this fragmentation of land as a result of allotment. And then there's the compounded element of climate change and climate shift. You know, we can't take for granted that the limited amount of lands we've managed to either hang on to or reacquire since allotment in Oklahoma statehood, we can't take for granted that those plants that are supported by them are going to be there despite, you know, different changes that we see happening, whether that be higher annual temperatures, different, you know, patterns of flooding and drought, and then the constant threat of you know, fragmentation due to cattle ranching, which involves clearing forests and other development activities that are threatening the cultural plants that Cherokee people know. And so that all just kind of puts it into this perspective of, when you look at and you kind of zoom out on our homelands, which, you know, Cherokee people still maintain relationships with our homelands in what is now known as Western North Carolina, basically the Southern Appalachian Mountains, and so Northern Georgia, Eastern Tennessee, and Northern Alabama. But of course, you know, for those who aren't living there, and so we have the Eastern Band, another federally recognized Cherokee tribe. But for Cherokees living in Oklahoma who are either Cherokee Nation citizens or citizens of the United Kituwa Band, you know, getting back home, so to speak, getting back to the homelands is a costly endeavor. And so what we've seen historically through removal is, again, when you look at these different landscapes, compare the Southern Appalachians to what is now northeastern Oklahoma, there are some significant similarities. I mean, it's not the same. And, you know, we have to recognize that those lands are the homelands of other indigenous peoples, Osage, Caddo, and Quapaw, and others who still have sacred sites within them. And so what this has meant for Cherokees, and, you know, it's a complex history, but what it's meant for me is looking at this through the lens of a relational continuity, of a maintaining indigenous responsibilities and obligations of care to the land despite forced dispossession and displacement. And so, you know, thinking about this in terms of a way of relating that isn't in itself a technology if you will. And so I'm just kind of playing with this word technology, because oftentimes it's meant to, you know, it's implied that it's like the through some sort of, you know, Western scientific means, you're solving a problem, and you know, maybe that results in a product or a, you know, application. So I'm kind of like reframing the word technology to emphasize the different types of technologies that we need to think about and learn from today that have more to do with relationality and care for the land and for, you know, between each other as human beings and between human beings and other than human beings. So plant relatives, animal relatives, the land itself, as a way of kind of reframing how we think about solving the issues that we're confronted with regard to the climate crisis. And so the Cherokee story of forced relocation, there's actually another story to that too, that I'll try not to go on a tangent about, but you know, before the Trail of Tears, there were Cherokees who migrated west across the Mississippi River, and they came to be known as the Old Settlers or the Western Cherokees. But you know, with that experience, Cherokee people were relating to lands west of the Mississippi, you know, long before the Trail of Tears. And so we have a sense of relationality with those lands and a sense of connection to them that spans, you know, generations. And that manifests today in really sustaining who we are as Cherokees through these land-based practices. And we were, I really hate to use the word fortunate, because there's nothing fortunate about being dispossessed from your homelands. But nonetheless, the plants that we knew in the East, some of them, not all of them, but some of them were present in the Western lands in what is now Eastern Oklahoma. And through that process of still kind of maintaining this land-based way of life, we've been able to continue some practices like traditional medicine, you know, crafts and food ways that have sustained who we are as Cherokee people in relation to the land. And as, and again, through this lens of like technologies of care or relational continuity, as I'm calling it, an obligation to caretake lands that may not be the homelands, but it's honoring what one of my elders called honoring the spirit of this land. And so it's complex, because, you know, we acknowledge that we were relocated there as a product of colonialism. And in the process of that, you know, our Osage relatives were, you know, dispossessed of their lands as well. Caddo relatives, Quapaw. And so it's this kind of complex history, but at the same time, this through line is, again, the obligation to honor our relatives, honor ancestral teachings of what it means to be good human beings and what it means to uphold those reciprocal responsibilities as Indigenous people to the land. So, you know, that's kind of what informs a lot of my ongoing work and thinking about that, you know, kind of broad picture in relation to, again, the continual threats, the continual obstacles that we have to deal with regarding you know, the manifestations of settler colonialism and settler land policy.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to, after the break, I want to dive more into some of those last things that you just said. But for right now, we will be right back. Okay. We are back from our break. And okay, you were talking about some different things right at the end of the last segment. And one question that it really made me think of is, obviously, we know that climate change is, you know, it's not a good thing. And it's disproportionately affects Indigenous people across the world, and not good. But on the other hand, you're talking about, you know, the resilience of the Cherokee people and these technologies of care and relationships, et cetera. Does that give you some hope in looking at climate change? Maybe compared to the rest of us that maybe don't have those things. Mm-hmm. How do you see that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I can look to a couple of projects that we're doing that are actively working to ensure that Cherokee people have lands and places on which to continue these practices and therefore transmit to future generations, younger generations, and see that continuity, that continuance, if you will, of who we are as a people. And again, kind of as a people, but in relation to the land, right? And those two projects are, well, they're related, and it actually is kind of a segue into my current work, and which has been, you know, technically since 2017, the pandemic has really created a huge obstacle in, you know, the timeline that we're working within. But it's a 5-year project. We've got a 1-year extension. It's funded through the National Science Foundation, and it's supported through a mechanism called the Early Career Award, which by definition or by the nature of the mechanism has to have equal parts research and education. And so, you know, this was a opportunity that I saw that I knew that I could apply to and would be appropriate for the work we're doing. But I went to the medicine keepers and said, you know, is this something that you see as worthwhile? And if so, you know, how would we envision this? And, something that they had been talking about for quite some time was, you know, yes, we exist as a group. And so my book really looks at them as a formation of a counterbalance to a heavily bureaucratic tribal government, and really asserting their voice within the way that decisions get made and, you know, different policies and basically the way that the tribe relates to its land base and the reservation, as we call it today. But looking ahead, they were always saying, well, you know, what we do is really important, but what is it really doing if we don't have active interactions and programs with younger generations? And so that became the focus of the education component of the NSF grant proposal, which again started in 2017. We spent the first year in workshop and planning mode, designing a curriculum for a land education program for Cherokee younger people. And that process was just awesome. It was a way for them to really open up about what they envisioned as the teachers, as the professors, if you will, of this program. But also it opened up a space for them to talk about how it would refuse or would not privilege the type of Western knowledge that was forced down their throats through the boarding school process. And so, you know, many of our elders who are around today also experienced that boarding school assimilatory method of education. And so actively kind of working to push back against that was a big topic during our workshops for the curriculum development. And, you know, a number of principles arose that served to ground this program. And again, it's all thinking about the nature of what it means to learn for Cherokee people, what it means to teach and learn, and what it means to relate and be in good relationship to the land and one another. And those principles, there are 4 of them. One of them in the language is Nigad Gust, which means we are all related, both, you know, between each other as human beings, but also between human beings and our non-human relatives, plants, animals, and spirits, and the land itself. The second one is the Cherokee word for teach me. It really translates to show me. So that word is skweyohaga. And that principle of skweyohaga, teach me, or more accurately, show me, is kind of implying both, well, 2 things. One, that learning is non-hierarchical and that learning is experiential. The third principle is in the Cherokee language, skinogigaweska. And that was offered by one of the elders as a way of talking about communalism. So it means if we work together, we'll get something done. So celebrating the collective endeavor of the group, as well as the individual gifts and traits that everyone brings to the table in that process. And the 4th principle is Ali Heleji Dasti, which means enjoyment or pleasure, having fun. And I say that is like the most important of all the principles. I mean, they're all important, but the value of you know, getting people together in joy and in pleasure and just kind of generally being happy on the land is a radical act for Indigenous people who have been dispossessed over and again and forcibly told to assimilate, but also just because that joy produces so much well-being and conversations and free flowing, you know, stories and knowledge sharing. And just that principle alone has made all the difference in this program, which has gone on to recruit 5 Cherokee students in the cohort. And it was designed as a 3-year pilot program. Of course, as I said, the pandemic really threw a wrench in that timeline. But nonetheless, it's been a way for this cohort to really know the medicine keepers and therefore kind of gain a training in traditional knowledge, as well as, you know, where we work hand in hand with the Secretary of Natural Resources Office. And so they get some insight from our tribal cultural biologists on the programs that they're working with within the tribe, and also the kind of policy issues that come up. So dealing with fractionated lands, checkerboarded lands as a result of the allotment policy. They're actively working to inform the Cherokee Nation's land conservation strategy. And so that program, and I have to mention the research component too, because that's the other half of the grant. And the research component is that they are essentially research assistants, and we work together with 3 different rural Cherokee communities within our reservation to really ask these questions about how Cherokee people are navigating such landscapes. And so it's kind of this issue of, despite all these obstacles and the compounded influence or effects of climate change, how are Cherokee people continuing to be resilient and continuing to live these ways of life, these land-based ways of life? And what can that say, or how can that inform, again, feeding back into tribal conservation policy? So basically, like, how the tribe can strategically target areas to conserve that can be locally managed and taken care of from each of those communities' perspectives, and how that can inform kind of this broader plan, if you will, that connects the importance of, you know, our sovereignty, our language, and centrally, you know, the land on which we practice all of the above, and the land that informs all of the above. So looking at that project, and we're also funded generously through the Indian Land Tenure Foundation for the land education program. What that has resulted in, and through the work of the medicine keepers and the student cohort, are some really, I think, hopeful, certainly exciting and forward-looking initiatives and endeavors that are both internal, so internal to our reservation and our tribe, but also that expand beyond and into partnerships with federal agencies like the National Park Service. On an internal level, the medicine keepers and I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, but the medicine keepers and I did a project back in 2015 that was a photo voice project. And through that, and essentially what a photo voice project is that you have a group or a community group with a defined kind of set of themes or a couple of concepts that serve as the guiding theme. In this case, the group was the medicine keepers, and the themes were land and health. You give them cameras and say, you know, go out and take pictures, and within a certain amount of time, I think this was 3 to 5 weeks, and take pictures of it, you know, places, anything that kind of connects those dots for you. And then you reconvene both individually and as a group to talk about the individual photographs. And what we did as a product of the Photo Voice project was we put together a 30-minute still image video. And that's actually available on YouTube with the elder's blessing. So everyone can go and check it out. It's called Cherokee Voices for the Land. And what that video did was it inspired the creation of legislation from our tribal counselors to develop a conservation act, if you will. I don't remember the exact title, but it enabled current tribal trust lands to be put into conservation status for traditional use only. And most recently, so I guess a year ago, so that's March 2021, the Cherokee Nation signed that act into law. And we saw the creation of the tribe's first conservation tract in eastern Adair County, which borders the Arkansas boundary. And that's the place where the elders, the medicine keepers, and the students, the cohort, practice and carry out this educational program. So that's significant. So yeah, looking outward or kind of more externally from our reservation lands, we're working with the National Park Service, and we recently, back in March of 2021, signed an agreement, plant gathering agreement with the Buffalo National River, which is in northern Arkansas. And so, you know, we think about the significance of that and really the strategy of that as being, you know, seeing the impacts that climate change is having on the lands that we have some, you know, modicum of control over, you know, within the reservation area in northeastern Oklahoma. And then to the point that I made previously, that we have no guarantee that the plants that reside within those boundaries of our checkerboarded, you know, landscape of tribal trust lands are going to stay put or are going to survive the impacts of what is becoming more and more, threats due to climate change. And so looking to the east and seeing, you know, aside from the ambitious kind of aspirational goal of reclaiming our homelands in the southeast, how can we confront these changes, these inevitable changes that are closer to us, where most Cherokee people reside today? Looking to the east, we see Buffalo National River as it definitely has its complications when you get into the history of conservation and the establishment of parks in the United States. But, you know, aside from the model being imperfect, that what happened, I think it was around 2014, the National Park Service issued a rule in the Federal Register that allowed for the establishment of gathering agreements between tribes and individual parks. And the tribes had to speak to, you know, their historical connections, ancestral connections to those lands. And so we see, again, I mentioned earlier in our conversation, the migration of Cherokee people before the Trail of Tears, so before 1838, 1839. And if you look back, Cherokee people were in that part of what is now Arkansas for quite some time. And in fact, there are treaty lands, historical treaty lands, that if you look at the map of the treaty lands and the map of the present day Buffalo National River, and it's, you know, they're right on top of one another. And that was the Treaty of 1817, which was since nullified, I guess, is one way to put it. Of course, that was on the heels of the Trail of Tears, in which Cherokee people were moved to what is now Oklahoma, but at that time was simply the Cherokee Nation or Indian Territory. But nonetheless, what I'm getting at is that Cherokee people have relationships with those lands, and we've been able to establish that agreement through the work of the medicine keepers who have lent their expertise to develop something that would enable Cherokee people far into the future to go and gather within the park boundaries, and therefore kind of create this, you know, what you could see as like a eco-cultural insurance policy, you know, because, again, despite the dark history of the Park Service and the establishment of parks, there's this, you know, sense of, you know, what surrounds Buffalo National River are, you know, farmlands and areas in which people have, similar to Oklahoma, you know, cleared lands for cattle grazing and different other, you know, other different agricultural purposes. And, you know, even though Native people were blocked out of the park, you still have this level of protection, if you will. And so it's like this strange kind of situation in which the park is, on the one hand has a dark history. On the other hand, it's like, okay, we can work with this agency to reconnect to this place in ways that acknowledges that people are a part of the environment and shouldn't be separated. And especially when it comes to Native practices of gathering that typically have just foundational principles of sustainability and reciprocity. And so the gathering agreement allows for that, as well as Cherokee input on the caretaking of those lands. And so, you know, the management, if you will. And so that happened in also in, goodness, March 2020. And so it's been a couple years. We've been wanting to go back and do the inaugural gathering. But of course, COVID has impacted that. We're looking toward a future date, maybe this fall, in terms of bringing the elders back with the students and enacting that first gathering activity or gathering event. And then talking about the significance of that agreement for our group and beyond, and you know, other Cherokees who would wish to go and gather there in a sustainable way and relate to those lands once again. So those are a couple of projects that really I think about when I think about, okay, looking toward the future, what gives me hope, what provides a sense of optimism despite all the challenges that we see coming down the pike with climate change and ongoing threats due to capitalist extraction and you know, settler colonial pressures, you know, and politics that that would otherwise like to see all of what I just said, you know, be discontinued or eradicated.
So we're coming up at the end of our time, but I did want to see if there was anything else that you really wanted to share with our listeners, any points that, you know, like if you had a soapbox of the one thing that you would want somebody to come away with, anything like that you wanted in this last little bit to share with our audience.
Sure. A soapbox. Well, I would say, you know, what's on my mind a lot is thinking about how we can look at the movement, the larger movement of land back through this lens of both aspiration, but also, you know, putting it in practice and seeing how there's a lot of different paths to that common or shared goal. And so, you know, what's on my mind in terms of that.
And to cut you off there, I'm not sure if all of our listeners know about the land back movement. So could you explain what that is?
Provide a little context?
Yes. Perfect. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, I mean, I always describe it as a movement that is, you know, centuries long, but only recently in the form of a hashtag. And it's, what I love about it is its provocative moniker of just simply the return of native lands to native people, the rematriation of lands generally. And, you know, the provocative nature of land back is that it doesn't answer in its, you know, in the hashtag, it doesn't answer how. It just, it is an assertion. It's a statement of what, and the how is something that we all need to figure out together, and that settler communities need to have serious conversations about, and that include Native nations, Native communities in that process. And so, again, the provocative nature of it is essentially the return of lands to Native people. The process of it is it can look a number of different ways, and it can be a matter of regaining access to lands that Native people have been dispossessed from. A colleague of mine wrote a book, her name's Beth Rose Middleton, wrote a book called Trust in the Land, which explores the use of tribal land trusts and cultural conservation easements in order for tribes to regain access to sacred sites, to gathering areas, to areas in which their relationships have been severed over time. And so I highly recommend that folks check that book out. But when we think of that movement, the land back movement broadly, you know, what are the pathways, multiple pathways that we can arrive at that shared goal? And in the way that I think about it, it's, you know, understanding that there are those aspirational goals, but there are also the kind of day-to-day, everyday acts that kind of move us toward that goal. And we see that manifest in things that, you know, I've mentioned before, with the work of the Medicine Keepers, you know, working with the National Park Service. But we can also see it as kind of opening up conversations about And this has happened a lot. We've done over the course of the pandemic, the students and I have presented together about our work. And we've had people come to us and whether it's in the Q&A or following up over email, express that, you know, they have land, you know, in Oklahoma and are, you know, inquiring as to kind of how can we work with your program? How can we work with the Medicine Keepers, with Cherokee Nation to allow for that, you know, that land back to happen? And that's been kind of the inspirational part of the work that we do, is that the more and we have this conversation, the more we hear from people about the work that we're doing and how they want to contribute in whatever form, that it becomes an open conversation about trying to figure this out together. And, you know, I'll just say that that's where a lot of, you know, my hope resides, is that, you know, it's not a forgetting of history or of, you know, disregarding what has happened in the past. Cause, you know, as Indigenous people, we'll never forget those types of atrocities that have been committed against us and committed against the land. But we also acknowledge that we're going to have to work together to resolve, or I wouldn't say resolve, but to address that history in ways that allows for the return of caretaking responsibilities and oversight that Indigenous people have to the land. And I guess that's a good note for me to end on, is that when we think about land back, a lot of people might view that or read that in a way that implies like repossession. And, you know, that's a part of the picture for sure. Title to lands is going to also convey the caretaking oversight, if you will. But I think Leanne Simpson, Anishinaabe scholar, said this or wrote this somewhere, but the opposite of dispossession is not necessarily possession. And so the land back movement, for me at least, implies much more than just the return of title, the return of property. It's kind of a reframing of the property conversation and what quote unquote management, land management means. And it's the return of the ethics and the frameworks that Indigenous peoples have that speak to what it means to be a good human being, a good part of creation, a good part of the land. That is the significant part of land back for me. And so, you know, I look at our work holistically as something that is enacting this, and that is enacting all kinds of things back. Some of you out there may have seen that t-shirt or that poster that says, you know, all of these things back, like language back, culture back, you know, religion back, relationships back, and then land back. And I think that's a really effective way of showing how the land back movement is about so much more than just private property.
Yeah. All right. Well, I could interview you for many more hours, but unfortunately we are at our time. But thank you so much for coming on. And I hope that we get to have you on again sometime to talk about your more recent work and what the results were with the students and all of those good things. And just thank you again so much for taking the time to come on today.
Awesome. Yeah, it would be great. It's been wonderful speaking with you, Jessica, and thanks to you for putting this together and all the listeners out there. So, wadon, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo. We'll be right back.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Max Lander.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.